Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ahí va a llegar el gol del Arsenal. Ozil marca. Mesut Ozil,
cerrado el cabezazo, gol. Gol del Arsenal, que el cabezazo picado y el estreno del brasileño Gabriel en su primer partido con el Arsenal.
This is Arscast Extra.
Hello and welcome to another Arscast Extra, as always with James from Gunnerblog. James, it's a goodly morning.
It is a goodly morning. How are you doing,
Andrew? I'm all right, thanks. I'm all right. I'm enjoying the noise from next door. Your gardening neighbor is at it again.
He just stopped.
Wow.
It's meant to be.
Fantastic.
It's like all that shouting abuse at him out the window finally paid dividends. I mean, he will start again imminently. He is sawing the garden in half. From what I can hear, that appears to be what he's doing.
Okay, well, best of luck to him. It's not at all irritating for me or you or the listeners, so that's fine. I mean, you know, there's a level of inconsiderateness in this society, this world we live in right now, but this is taking the biscuit. But hey, he stopped probably for a biscuit, Kit Kat perhaps, cup of tea, that kind of a break.
Have a break, have a Kit Kat. Exactly.
That's it. So, how's it all going your end?
It's good, thanks, man. I mean, I'm sort of technically on holiday, but, you know, this is a pleasure, so I'm doing it anyway.
Yeah. Well, thanks.
Which means that listen, you should be very flattered indeed.
I am.
But, it was good. I mean, I caught quite a lot of the Premier League action over the weekend. I enjoyed what happened at Old Trafford enormously.
I did too, but I was also concerned by it.
Yes, you know, I read your blog this morning about, you know, what is happening to our game, effectively.
Our beautiful game that has been so pure and well run for many years. And now it's just a shambles, a travesty. Like, I loved it, too. I mean, I think, you know, it's hilarious to see Manchester United get a penalty given against them in the first place, considering how many they get. It's never a penalty. And then it's saved and then it's retaken and then they score. I mean, you can't help but laugh at Manchester United. There was a great clip of that Manchester United guy, you know, the video guy that sits there watching the game.
That dude.
Yeah, that guy. And he was going crazy when De Gea saved it. He was going like, yeah, take that, you people who don't like David De Gea. I love him. He's great. He's the best. Go fuck yourselves. And then he was like, oh, bloody hell, no. No, this is... So, I mean, you know, it adds layers to the enjoyment when things like that play out online, but part of me is sort of going, at some point we're gonna be in that situation and we are not gonna like it. And I think the handball rule in particular is such a load of bollocks these days I just fear, you know, we're gonna get smited by this regulation.
Well, I thought, didn't we see some of the inconsistency in action, you know, between the United game and our game? In terms of, I thought their handball was crazy harsh.
Yeah.
And, you know, if that's a handball, presumably what Gabriel did is also.
But how could what Gabriel did be a handball? Because he's sort of jumping forward and he mistimes it or whatever. His arms are out because nobody can do anything with their arms by their sides apart from doing an impression of a penguin. That is literally the only thing you can do as a human being with your arms by your side, or stand to attention if you're in the army or the Boy Scouts or whatever, or in boarding school, whatever the fuck, right? So you have to use your arms to jump. And I think it hit him. There's this new rule now, the t-shirt rule or whatever the fuck they call it, that if it's above the line of the shirt or whatever, I don't know how the fuck they're doing this. So I don't really understand.
Sleeves are going to get longer on football kits.
Exactly. Arsenal long kits all the way. Yeah. I mean, I don't really understand how or why that should be a penalty. If, you know, I think there's... I agree with you, by the way. But surely we have to be able, as football fans, as officials, to recognise that something is accidental and doesn't merit a penalty. Because, you know, it is a really harsh punishment. If you're standing there, you're a defender, and you're sort of running back with a guy, and your arms are kind of, you know, out because that's just the way it is, and a guy kicks a ball into your arm from 2 feet away... And the punishment for that is essentially the clearest goal-scoring chance you can have in football. That doesn't seem right to me. As amusing as it is when it happens to Manchester United, it feels like the punishment is completely disproportionate to the incident. It's the same as like a guy going into the box and basically getting tripped up. It doesn't really work for me.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree, and I don't think that should have been a penalty against Lindelof. I am on record as not liking the application of the technology, and nothing's changed there. I mean, I had texts off people this weekend during games, you know, football fans, people who really love football, and I know not everyone feels this way, but saying, Christ, what the hell is going on here? You know, what is happening? And I kind of... sympathise with that position.
What about What about the De Gea thing? I mean, where do we stand on this? Why is VAR being used to implement a rule when VAR was introduced as a way of getting rid of clear and obvious errors? Was that not the thinking behind VAR?
Yeah, I mean, I forget which pundit it was who said this, but it was someone who takes penalties. It might have actually been Danny Murphy. And he said something like, if the goalie comes off his line, the maximum distance he's coming off his line is like a foot. And as a penalty taker, it just wouldn't bother me remotely.
Mm.
And, you know, I get that. If a goalie rushes 6 yards out before making the save, I remember Dida doing that, I think, for AC Milan once, that's a bit different. But, I mean, when it is literally a centimetre, it does seem absurdly finickety. I know not everyone feels that way.
Yeah.
And there'll be people saying, the rules are the rules, the laws are the laws. And that's kind of fair enough. But I just find it needlessly petty.
Yeah, I mean... It boils down to this for me. Like, it's difficult enough for a goalkeeper. You know, take a good penalty and you score. That's the bottom line. Mm. If you take a good penalty, you're 12 yards out, you score. This makes it even more difficult for goalkeepers, in my opinion. And, yeah, I just... Like a guy,
it is a lot of this stuff is weighted towards goals, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's saying, let's have more penalties.
Let's have more goals.
Yeah. Yeah. I also found it weird, by the way, and this is sort of might seem strange, but I found it kind of odd that if you miss a penalty and it gets retaken, you could change the taker. I think that sits a bit uneasy with me as well. It feels like it kind of misses the point.
Make the guy do it again, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. If you're going to introduce weird arbitrary rules about how far a goalkeeper can come off his line and, you know, video technology looking at that, make the same guy do it. I think that's fair. I think that's right.
That said, Palace would have beaten United anyway because United were really funnily bad.
They were. It was an enjoyable win for Crystal Palace. But maybe we'll talk about something else in relation to that in a while. We should talk about Arsenal and talk about a 2-1 win over West Ham.
We were quite bad too.
We were. We were not great, in fairness. I don't think we were quite as bad as I thought when we were watching it, but... It still wasn't good. I mean, I think there were some issues that were very, very obvious within the game. And I enjoyed Mikel Arteta afterwards saying, I'm very pleased with the result, but in terms of the performance, there are many things that we need to work on. I found that honesty refreshing and endearing. And, you know, it's often the case that a manager will know fine well that his team has played poorly. But come out and say something like, we were very positive. The boys put in the hard work, you know, and we got repaid for our efforts. We kept going right to the end, didn't let our heads drop, the character, the team, blah, blah, blah. And they never addressed the fact that there were elements of the performance or elements of the game where it was just terrible. Didn't Unai Emery say something like that after a really bad performance? And he said, well, the game plan worked exactly how we wanted. Something like that. You know, that kind of nonsense that nobody needs. So I enjoyed that from Arteta.
Yeah, I enjoyed that too. And I also found it interesting that he said that the week's training was kind of the best he'd seen. So, you know, I felt like there was a bit of surprise from him in spotting as much negativity as he did. But I enjoyed that. I mean, something Unai Emery did often was kind of deflect the poor performances. And the first half, you know, was very stodgy. Periods of the second half were stodgy too. But we got the result. And, you know, Arteta made the point, this is a game that last season we'd probably draw or we'd probably lose.
Yeah.
And the fact we managed to get over the line is pretty significant. And you could see that in the celebrations at full time. You know, this win meant a lot to Arteta because ultimately it's 3 points from a situation where we didn't necessarily do enough to deserve them.
Yeah, that's true. And I think there's some there's something to that in the sense that he's right to point out that we didn't play well, that there are things to improve, that, you know, the way we used the ball wasn't good enough. I think that's what he said. You know, the training was the best week's training I've had since we came here, and the first 15 minutes was the worst we've been on the ball since I arrived. So, you know, he wasn't blind to that. But I also do think there is something to what he says about last season. This is a game we would have drawn. We would not have found that winning goal. Or, you know, as happened at Brighton towards the end of last season, we let one in right at the end. And West Ham did have chances. So I think we have to as well give some credit to West Ham for a performance which made things very difficult for us. You know, they matched us in terms of formation. So they were set up in a way which was going to make life really difficult for us. You could see from the very start that they were trying to block off passing lanes. Ceballos and Xhaka found it difficult, I think in the early stages in particular. So, you know, as poor as we were, sometimes we don't take into account the performance of the opposition. I'm not saying West Ham were brilliant, but I think the way that they played, and if you're, you know, a manager, I know David Moyes, people have a laugh at David Moyes and everything else, but, you know, he's a very experienced manager. He knows Arteta. He knows how to set up a team to make life difficult for the opposition. I think he did that to an extent with the way he sent his team out.
Yeah, I thought they did deploy pretty smartly. They deployed like a team who'd watched us against Fulham pretty closely. And, you know, their front three were quite narrow, so they were quite congesting that central area, blocking off passing lanes. They also, you know, Fulham neglected to use Mitrovic against Arsenal, which the more you look at it, the stranger a decision it becomes.
Yeah.
West Ham, I mean, to be honest, even if Antonio hadn't played, it would have been Haller, who's not bad at that. But Antonio is a real battering ram up front. I mean,
he's a good player.
He's quick. Yeah, he is. And he tests centre-halves every time. I think it's encouraging that he was pulling onto Holding whenever he could, because I think it shows you that Gabriel could kind of go toe-to-toe with a player like that. But he caused us problems on the counter-attack as well. So West Ham were decent and probably feel a bit hard done by, but obviously we don't care.
No, of course, we don't care about the opposition. And, you know, again, we're here trying to find the balance between performance versus result. It's early in the season. There's a lot going on. You know, and I'm also aware of the fact that there were times when we got good results under Unai Emery and we expressed concerns about the level of performance. So, you know, it's trying to find the balance when we come to the analysis. But what I would say is this. The first thing that occurs to me, well, I mean, just in terms of the lineup, I don't think it was a surprise to see Saka starting at home and Ceballos coming in for Elneny. Not a surprise either, given we were at home. Beyond that, anything in the starting lineup that surprised you? I mean, apart from the injury, which I'm going to talk to you about now in the
warm-up. Well, yeah, that go on then. That would be you know, I think that was a factor in how much we struggled in the first half.
Now, this is a really interesting aspect of how we play in this system under Mikel Arteta. Kieran Tierney is really good. Mm-hmm. Everyone loves Kieran Tierney, and we can see what a difference he makes when you put a player like Kolasinac in, who just simply cannot do 20% of the stuff that Tierney does when it comes to using the ball and getting us going forward. And there's a sort of he feels like a very inhibited player, because I think he plays it a lot more safe now in terms of possession, Kolasinac, which means he goes backwards a lot more.
Yeah.
But Kieran,
his confidence probably isn't all that either, because I think he probably senses he's on the way out. And to be honest, even when it is up, He's just not a great technical footballer.
No, I mean, look, I think if you get him running down the left-hand side in that left wing-back position, head down, charging at the opposition right back or whatever it might be, you know, he can be effective and was effective for a time, wasn't he? Maybe last season or the season before, we were using him as basically our only creative outlet, which when you think about it now is just crazy. But there you go. That's what it was. And to be fair to him, he did quite well. And I think in those kind of circumstances, you can get stuff out of him. But in this particular role, I think what was really striking about the performance on Saturday was just how fundamental Tierney is in the system that Mikel Arteta wants us to play with this back three, and how he uses the various pieces within that back three. So by being really good, Kieran Tierney has kind of created a problem in a way, because he's so particular. He is the only guy in the squad who can really do that job as it stands.
Well, he plays two positions, basically, in the course of 90 minutes. He plays as the third centre-half and as the left-back when we're in possession. Kolasinac, you know, can barely manage one. And it was a huge, huge blow, because suddenly you've got Kolasinac there. He's not very progressive on the ball, and the patterns of play are disruptive. And actually, you know, as much as I was like pleased to see Saka come in, it's a really hard game to analyse this, because I kind of felt that without Tierney and Maitland-Niles on that kind of left-hand axis of the team, I felt like it was almost too disruptive, and we really sort of struggled to get any kind of momentum going, because that's a really important side for our build-up usually. However, Saka, who played as a left wing-back and overall I thought didn't have an amazing game, by playing in that position got into advanced areas where he made the difference and kind of won the game for us. So it's kind of tricky to analyse. And similarly, you know, in the first half, our central midfield I thought were really, really poor. But I thought in the second half they kind of stepped it up, and Ceballos ends up getting the assist for the winner. So some of the things that I looked at during the game was like, ah, this is a real problem, actually.
Yeah.
In a weird way, kind of turned out, you know, helping us win.
Well, I mean, yeah, look, I think what you're saying is that players who didn't have great games overall still produce moments which helped us win the game. What's really interesting, when you look at the first goal again, I watched it back this morning. Saka, a couple of times within that spell of possession, is the furthest man forward for Arsenal. And he sort of hangs on the shoulder of the last defender, then drops back into midfield, and then we work the ball around again, and he hangs on the shoulder and then drops back into midfield, which is where ultimately he picks up a pass from Xhaka. I don't know if you spotted this, but, you know, Xhaka, not that he's easy to play against, but you know he likes the ball on his left foot, so you can organise yourself.
Yeah.
So he takes the ball and he plays a right-footed pass through to Saka, who then plays it through to Aubameyang to Lacazette goal. But he's sort of, what's interesting about that is that Xhaka plays that pass before the West Ham midfielders look to close him down on his left foot.
Yeah, it's really unusual, but it is a line-splitting pass from Shaka's right foot. So,
what's quite interesting about it is you can sort of, it's very noticeable that he plays it with his right foot, because you know the way sometimes when you play the ball with your wrong foot, you know, your legs don't quite go the same way. It just sort of sticks out a bit. It's quite funny.
It is. It's remarkable in that it's not something we see too often. So let's celebrate it when we do. Saka takes it brilliantly. And actually, the way Saka plays that through ball is actually quite impressive, because the ball kind of skips away from him a little bit and it's almost between his feet, and he manages to kind of get behind it and squeeze it through. It's quite impressive feat of coordination and balance. And you're right to point out his position. I mean, actually, at Fulham, you know, Maitland-Niles was sometimes getting into those areas, but something we've seen with Maitland-Niles is that obviously while he gives you so much defensively, you know, he's not brilliant receiving the ball back to the goal on the turn 30 yards from the opposition goal. Saka is so much better there. Finds Aubameyang. Brilliant, brilliant pick out from Aubameyang. And Lacazette finishes the header very, very nicely. But a great spot from Aubameyang, who sort of sees the run at the near post, delays, sees where Lacazette's going and puts it into the perfect area.
It's a great cross with his wrong foot as well.
Yeah. So we go. A few wrong feet involved in that one.
Yeah.
And yeah, that was a really nice goal, actually. And I thought, oh, here we go. But it, while we did improve after that, I still don't think we were anything like our full potential.
Yeah, look, I don't think anybody really played particularly well overall. You know, Willian, as good as he was against Fulham, I think struggled to find those combinations on the right-hand side. And maybe it was to do with the way West Ham were set up. But I thought he played... He played a bit more centrally, if I'm remembering it right, and he just didn't look quite on his toes at times. I don't know what that was.
I know what you mean, particularly in the first half. In the second half, interestingly, he was turning up on the left-hand side a lot of the time. We were really overloading that side. You know, it became like four players on that flank at one point. Just going back to Tierney and him being absent and how much it affected us, did you think, were you surprised that Arteta went for Kolasinac? Did you think there was another option? Could he have brought Luiz in and tried to put Gabriel in that area?
Yeah. I mean, that was, I saw a lot of people wondering why he didn't play Ainsley Maitland-Niles. And I was, well, you know, Maitland-Niles is not a left-sided centre-back. You know, Tierney has to fulfil two roles in the team. So Maitland-Niles could play out on the left-hand side and has played left-back. But it's a very different thing to play and quite a specialised thing to play in that left-centre-half role. So... You know, yeah, he could have brought Luiz in. I just can only assume that there's an issue with Luiz's fitness. He wasn't confident, perhaps, that he would have lasted the 90 minutes. And again, it highlights just how unique Tierney's skill set is in this particular squad. Because even if you did bring Luiz in, you play Gabriel on the left-hand side of a back three, you can't play the same way. So I'm really curious as to what the long-term plan is here. Like, is Tierney... Is Tierney going to be our left-sided centre-back, or is he going to be a left-back, left-wing-back? If he's that, then we've got players who can play in that position, because Maitland-Niles can do it, Saka can do it. If you play with a Gabriel or Pablo Marie, for example, as your left-sided centre-half in a back three, it's a different role completely. Surely you cannot ask those guys to do what Tierney does, because, you know, they're bigger, they're not as mobile, they can't get up and down the pitch as well as he can. So it would require a kind of a shift in terms of the implementation of that system. It'll be the same system, but just we do things slightly differently.
Yeah, it's a really good point. I mean, in my mind, when I kind of envisaged us line up with this back three, I was kind of thinking, well, maybe Gabriel could be, you know, the left-sided centre-half at times, or maybe Pablo Marie could be. But when you think about what Tierney does, when Arsenal are in possession, he often ends up kind of as an overlapping fullback. It's very difficult to envisage Pablo Marie storming into the, you know, the opponent's half to swing in crosses.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Maybe Maitland-Niles could be coached to do it, maybe. Mm. But I think it's, you know... Half the time you're defending the width of your own penalty area. It involves marking, offside traps, aerial ability. It feels a stretch right now. So, yeah, he is kind of irreplaceable at Tierney right now. And I mean, unfortunately, that's what happens when you get really, really good players. They become really difficult to replace. Yeah. What about the West Ham equaliser? I mean, we probably could have done with someone like a Tierney in that situation too.
Yeah, look, I was sitting there and, you know, I'm watching the game on my own and I'm doing the live blog and I'm shouting at the television like anyone can hear me, but I was just shouting at them, you know, stop backing off, stop backing off. So I think we could have done more to close the West Ham attack down. I mean, I think what Arteta will look at is the fact that this goal came from an Arsenal attack, which broke down on the edge of their box. Bellerin had played a really nice ball out to Willian on the right-hand side, and he was looking, I think, for Saka in the middle. And it broke down, and from there, you know, West Ham had a lot of time and a lot of space. It was a bit too easy. So, you know, there's part of me thinking we should have taken a yellow card and just taken a foul and stopped the move higher up the pitch. Maybe Xhaka could have done that. Of course, Xhaka would then be criticised all over the place for, you know, a clumsy Xhaka tackle moment, even though I would have been absolutely fine with it. I think Kolasinac was really poor, didn't get anywhere near the guy crossing. And Rob Holding in the middle, I saw people questioning his positioning, and I thought, well, that's not right. His positioning is good. In terms of where he needs to be. You know, he's got the man, he's goal side of the man, and he can see what's happening. He just stops at some point and pauses, and maybe he's thinking about offside, but he just didn't react quickly enough. He needed to be closer to the man to prevent the chance. So poor defending overall.
Yeah, exactly. The guy gets across him. But I think Xhaka and Kolasinac continue to back off is sort of the criminal factor there. And yeah, it put West Ham back in the game. It dramatically changed David Moyes' half-time team talk, you imagine. But maybe, in a way, it kind of gave Arsenal a bit of a kick up the arse too. And
Did it really?
I can't remember, truth be told.
I was thinking, well, you know, the drinks breaks, which used to be so effective for Mikel Arteta, he's only got one of those now, and it's half time. So I was looking for
Arsenal to
really be, you know, at it in the second half. But I don't think we were. I mean, there were moments, and you know, we had plenty of the ball, but I just wasn't quite there in terms of how we performed. And certainly, West Ham had some moments of real danger. Hit the bar. Leno landed on his face on the ball.
That was scary looking.
It was.
He could have really hurt himself,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah. I mean, and that was sort of accidental because I think he went over the back of, was it Gabriel?
Yeah.
So, yeah, look, there were some moments when West Ham caused us problems. We can't be blind to that.
I mean, the attempts stats kind of tell their own story to an extent, don't they? I mean, Arsenal's were pretty low for a home team, and West Ham significantly higher.
Yeah.
I think the XG was not quite so dramatically weighted in one side.
But, right.
Yeah, they certainly had, you know, a few attempts on our goal.
Right. So the other thing, I suppose, that struck me about this game, this performance overall, as Xhaka and Ceballos... there's a good video actually doing the rounds of Xhaka, and I think you tweeted it, or it's on your timeline anyway, and I looked at it as well. Xhaka in the second half, and I think you had said better than you remember, and that's absolutely true. He was better than I remembered. But also, yeah, I feel like that particular partnership with Xhaka and Ceballos, I think it works. And when it works, it's pretty good. I mean, it's pretty good. But it's not any better than pretty good. And I feel like in games like this, we need more than pretty good. Now, we dug it out. We got the goal, and we'll talk about the goal in a minute. But it really hammered home to me the need for something else in midfield. And it was quite interesting, or whatever way you want to frame this in your own mind, you and everyone listening, that when... or just before the goal that won the game, ultimately, we were about to bring on Mohamed Elneny for Dani Ceballos. Now, that, you know, is not a slight on Elneny in any way, shape, or form, but it tells you something about the midfield options that Mikel Arteta feels he has available to him at this moment in time.
It does, and actually something I was going to say in part, sort of, you know, discussing the first half, was that this game made me miss players that I shouldn't miss. So I found myself watching the first half thinking, I really wish, you know, David Luiz was out there because it would give us a bit more variety from the back. And I actually found myself wishing that Mohamed Elneny was out there in the first half because Ceballos, well, I think he is a better player than Elneny. I'm not crazy. Elneny's passing against Fulham, granted there was a bit more space to do it, was actually relatively progressive. He looked forward a lot more than we're used to seeing him do. And I felt like Ceballos in the first half really wasn't offering that. And yeah, so when that change was being made, I was kind of like, yeah, well, that's sort of fair enough. But I agree with you. It's not an inspiring change, and it's not one that you think, well, this is really going to crank up the pressure and help us win the game.
No, I think what Ceballos was guilty of in the first half in particular was just that thing that he does where he takes too many touches before he uses the ball.
Slows
it down a bit too much. And that, along with my personal bugbear of players not passing the ball hard enough to each other, you know, just sort of rolling the passes and we'll move it across and that kind of thing. But, you know, what Ceballos showed for the goal. And, you know, I think afterwards as well, you know, he made a big contribution to the goal, obviously with the assist. But I think as well, there was a really important moment after we'd scored, probably in injury time. I can't remember what it was, but West Ham had come down the right-hand side, our right-hand side, cross back into the box, a low ball for a guy to have a shot, and Ceballos nipped in and got the ball and got a kick at the same time. So,
yeah,
you know, he didn't have a great game overall, but as you pointed out earlier, there were moments where, you know, he proved very valuable and made a big contribution to the result.
He's a fighter, isn't he? And I do like that about it. There's a nice moment on the left touchline, wasn't there, where he kind of went to ground but managed to keep the ball in play, sort of fell and hooked it down the line. You know, he is someone who has a very obvious passion in the way he plays, and it kind of... I like the way that he expresses that, and I thought, you know, he did make really telling contributions. I mean, in the second half, I mentioned this earlier, but we were looking to overload that left-hand side. Willian was heading over there. Kolasinac was much higher up. Saka was sort of tucked in field a bit. And the goal, when it comes, is good again. I mean, it's a really lovely pass from Saka, you know, for the second time in the game. You know, Ozil-esque, you'd have to say, you know, splitting the defence and playing Ceballos in to square for Nketiah.
Yeah.
I was terrified it was offside, I must say.
Yeah, I was a little bit, but yeah, I'm just watching it again here. Ceballos, or Saka picking it up from Ceballos.
There's about four West Ham defenders, I think, in front of Saka, and he manages to kind of see the run, find the space.
Yeah, it's quite a... I'm not sure Ceballos necessarily expected all the West Ham players to run away from him, because they all go like school kids towards the ball. He just kind of keeps running beyond, rather than... you know, he's not actually making a run and going, give me the ball, give me the ball. It's not one of those runs. He just kind of runs beyond.
Yeah.
And
right.
then all of a sudden it opens up for him. And, you know, it was a lovely pass by Saka. So, you know, involved in two goals. Not going to go down the whole pre-assist route, but, you know, big contributions. And Eddie Nketiah, penalty box, you expect him to? From the angle you're looking at, I can see why you'd think it was offside, because he does look ahead of Ceballos and ahead of the ball. Yeah. But, you know, when it comes around the other way.
No, he controls it pretty well. I mean, obviously, and it's a gift once it's on a plate like that from Ceballos. And funny, wasn't it, that it was those two combining after what we saw before the Fulham game as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was resolved pretty quickly, as I think they both said. And they both wanted to play. That's why they were frustrated. And in the next game, Ceballos has got an assist and Nketiah's got a goal, a winning goal for us. So, you know.
Really valuable, that goal. Really valuable.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, it's the difference on the night. And, look, I mean, that 3 points is big, because Arsenal have got, you know, a couple of tough games this week. They got Leicester and then Liverpool on the Monday, actually, it is.
Yeah.
And so, you know, getting Leicester's in the cup, admittedly, but, you know, 6 from 6 from the opening two Premier League games, especially when you haven't played very well in one. I mean, that's the thing. You want to maximise points when you play well, of course, but if you can take points when you don't, that's really going to help, because there are going to be games like this where it doesn't click, where it doesn't happen. Even with, you know, with the best will in the world, when the training has gone brilliantly, sometimes it will just not work.
Mm.
And if you can win in that scenario, you're in a decent place.
Yeah, look, you have to be able to dig out results like that. And that's something Arteta said as well, that you are going to get games like this. You have to somehow find a way of winning. And again, it comes back to, you know, how much stock you put in the result versus the performance and everything else. But, you know, being able to dig out wins is a good thing. It's a positive thing. And I think we've made this point before. Certainly, as we sit here after the game and we analyze every aspect of it and every aspect of the performance, I don't think players do. I mean, I'm not blind to the fact that Mikel Arteta is going to sit them down and go over some of the shit that didn't go well against West Ham. They're not going to be ignorant to that fact. But I think when you're playing you're looking first and foremost at the result. You're taking the confidence and the belief from the result much more than the performance, I think. So, you know, it will be a confidence boost to the players, to the goal scorer, to Nketiah, to Ceballos getting an assist. And, you know, there is something to be said for that character. I think what was interesting as well, one of the other things Arteta said was, I think he said basically, sometimes you need games like this. As well as having to win them and having to do, he says, sometimes you need games like this to sort of look at, okay, well, how do we manage? How do we cope with things like this? And maybe we needed something like this so he can sit down and think, well, how do I do what I want the team to do without a key piece of it in the shape of Kieran Tierney?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's illustrated an issue, and it'll be fascinating to see how he deals with that going forward. I mean, from what we hear, Tierney's absence was precautionary, right? There was no kind of major injury concern there. But, you know, he's a player who, unfortunately, has a history of injuries. Touch wood, that doesn't rear its head this season, but it could. So it's something to consider.
Yeah, I mean, were you maybe a little bit surprised that as the game went on, we didn't think about changing the formation? In going going to a back four, and you could have Gabriel holding Bellerin and Saka. Obviously, yeah. Kolasinac would have been the guy to come off. And then you could put the extra player on in midfield. Even if it was Elneny, you could push Ceballos further forward. We had Pepe, of course. You could have kept Willian on.
I thought that might happen. I thought Pepe might come on and play, you know, next to Willian. And we might go to a four and add an extra attacking player there. Yeah, I did consider that. And it's interesting that that isn't the change that was made. I feel like at the back end of last season, we were really thinking, well, sooner or later, it's going to be a back four. And I feel like the longer it goes, the more I'm thinking, later, it's going to be a back four.
It does feel like later. I mean, maybe he just, you know, feels like the team are more comfortable in this particular setup, or they're more well-drilled in this particular setup. But he was talking beforehand about, I think he did a big interview with Sky Sports about, you know, having tactical variation and not being predictable. And I'm not saying we are necessarily predictable, although, you know, West Ham set up their team with the knowledge, more or less, that we were going to, you know, send our team out the way that we did. You know, so maybe there is something to work on in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, Arteta will probably say, well, look, when we have the ball, it is a back four, you know, and I do understand that. But I did just think we might overload an attacking player by getting Pepe on a bit higher with Willian still there. But then he went a different way. He overloaded on the left-hand side, Kolasinac, Saka, you know. And ultimately, that's kind of the half of the pitch that the goal comes from. So he'll feel justified in that. But there will be tactical variation. It was just an interesting case study, wasn't it? Because all the great Arsenal performances we've sort of seen in the past few months have either come away from home, in the case of Fulham, against a team who, you know, have plenty of problems themselves, or against big sides. And this was the kind of quintessential home game against a team who, you know, are very compact and looking to hit you on the break. And can we break them down effectively? And actually, I think that our greatest failure for me was sort of not so much one of system, but one of sort of ideas and patterns in terms of movement and progressing the ball. I just didn't feel that they were there as much as you would hope. And of course, players can improve that, you know, and that signings might improve that. But it's just the patterns of play just weren't as sharp as they were against Fulham. And this is the test that Arteta needs to overcome, I think, this season, this kind of game.
Yeah, but it was only Fulham, remember, and this was West Ham.
The mighty West Ham.
The mighty West Ham.
The Hammers themselves.
There you go. But look, the main thing is, of course, that we've taken 3 points, a maximum 6 from 6 now from our first two Premier League games. And, you know, that is an important thing. It's easier, isn't it, to fix things or to go about your work anyway when you need to fix things, knowing that you've kind of got away with one. I think that's what Arteta's celebration at the end was. It was quite animated for him, you know, because, look, I think there was an element of wanting to beat David Moyes As much as he has a lot of respect for David Moyes from the time that he worked with him at Everton.
That. Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, I think that was part of it, but I also think it was like, oh fuck, we got away with that one. Thank goodness. You know, I think there was an element of that to his celebration, but it will make the work a little bit easier knowing that you got the points on the board. Knowing that, like last season, you draw this game or you lose it and you drop 2 points or 3 points. So,
oh, it feels like 2 3-point points. It feels like 2 points gained. Absolutely, you know. And the point about Moyes is a really interesting one. I didn't actually kind of think that they had been sort of, you know, player and manager at some point. But yeah, he got the better of him. Steve Round as well got the better of his former employer. So yeah. I'm sure they will have enjoyed that too.
For sure. All right. Well, look, we will take a break right here. We've plenty more to discuss. There's a game in midweek, of course, in the Carabao Cup. So we'll think about the team for that one in part two, which is coming right after this.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome back. Oh,
sorry.
That's okay.
Making a noise. Sorry again.
Will I go again or will I just continue?
Just to continue
the tradition of fucking up the start of this
show
bit.
That we are human.
It's not my fault this time. Welcome
it's
back.
It's not always your fault.
Welcome back to the Arscast Extra. This is part two where we answer questions that you send to us on Twitter at Gunnerblog and at Arsblog on the Arsblog Facebook page, facebook.com/ The Arsblog, and also on the Arsblog Discord channel or Discord chat server, which you get access to if you are an Arsblog member on Patreon. Now, we have a midweek game, Carabao Cup against Leicester City, away at Leicester City at the, what's it called? The Crispy Stadium, Walker's Crisps Bowl Stadium,
yes.
King Power Stadium.
KP Nuts Stadium.
That's exactly it. So we have a question here from Suel Parmar, who's at SParmar1105. He said, "Goodly morning, chaps. With the Carabao Cup around the corner, how much squad rotation are we expecting? Most likely candidates are Macy, Nelson and Eddie. But what about Ozil, Guendouzi and Socrates?" I mean, I'll leave it to you, but I mean, you could use a fringe team, which is quite a lot stronger than the word fringe would suggest.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, I think it won't be a weak side. I think it will be a rotated team. But let's have a look at the subs bench, for example. I think that, you know, Pepe's going to play.
Mm-hmm.
I think that... Well, probably everyone who was on the bench in that game's got a chance to play. So I would say Nketiah, probably Joe Willock, Pepe. I'm not sure if Macy will play. There's some talk this morning that maybe Renarsson could be eligible to play if...
deal goes through.
If the deal goes through, etc., etc. So maybe he might be a candidate. Beyond that, the three... Who did you mention? Guendouzi, Ozil...
Socrates. I mean, there's players who weren't in the squad, like Joe Willock was drafted in at the last minute, of course. Mm. Reece Nelson, Cedric. So, I mean, you could play Macy. Do you think we'll see William Saliba? Because he played with the under-23s
I think we will. Mm. Yeah.
I have a feeling we might, yeah.
I'm more confident we'll see William Saliba than I am that we'll see Guendouzi or Ozil. And I'm not saying that means we won't, but I'm just slightly more confident of Saliba.
That would suggest to me that if we're going to see Saliba, if he plays, I think it will probably mean that David Luiz would play just to sort of be that experienced guy to guide him through.
Yeah. And maybe Kolasinac will play again if there is any concern over Tierney.
I wouldn't risk Tierney before Anfield.
Exactly. So it's not an appealing prospect to play Kolasinac. But, you know, I think it might be the case. Mm. Wing-backs, I think Cedric will play.
Yeah, I do. Maitland-Niles on the left?
I guess, although I'm expecting him to play at Anfield as well. That would be the only caveat to that. But, you know, he's had a bit of a rest. He could share the game with somebody. I mean, I'm trying to think beyond that, who else have we got, really? You know, we've got Bowler, but I don't think he's convinced anyone massively at academy level. So, yeah, I think it probably will be Maitland-Niles. Midfield, Elneny's going to play, isn't he?
Elneny, Willock, and...
I mean,
yeah.
Yeah. That could be
the two.
Your front three, I think you'll see Pepe, Nelson and Nketiah.
That would make sense, given, you know, the way they've played. But, of course, you could bring in Guendouzi.
You could bring in
Mesut Ozil, yeah. So, I mean, do you expect either of those two to be involved?
I think if one's got a chance, I think I'd actually say it would be Ozil.
Mm.
Simply because I feel like he isn't going anywhere, whereas Guendouzi could still leave in this window.
But where does Ozil fit in this particular system?
Yeah, I mean, probably in this particular system, probably in kind of the role Willian's been playing, as a kind of tucked in inside forward. And actually, you know, that maybe that is sort of the use for him that Arteta will have. Maybe it will be in these cup games to lend a bit of experience. But it wouldn't surprise me either if we get an 18-man squad and he's not in it. You know, just the way it's been going,
yeah,
you couldn't be surprised by that.
No.
What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's probably more or less the team that we'll see. I don't see the need to risk anybody ahead of Anfield. Give Pepe some playing time. If you have some doubts over Luiz's fitness or match fitness, this is a good way of giving him that. But I think you keep as many of your key players out of the squad or on the bench as possible. So, yeah, I think it'll be also, a stronger team than it looks or it sounds, but I still think it'll be heavily rotated.
Yeah, and actually, you know, there's nothing to stop you taking a couple of big players on the bench, you know, if required. Because Arteta doesn't like to lose any games. You know, I think that's pretty clear. And he generally played stronger sides in the Cups than many expected him to at various different points in it last season. So he might be surprised. There might be, you know, one or two more big names out there that we might not think. But a lot of these players need game time, you know. You want them to be sharp. You want them to feel like they're part of things as well. That's a big thing for Arteta, you know. Someone like Reece Nelson, who can't even get on the bench, he's got to do something to make him feel part of it, you know.
Yeah, and also if you're Nicolas Pepe and you've lost your place in the team having ended last season very well and you've lost your place in the starting 11 to Willian, this is an opportunity for you to remind Mikel Arteta that there's, you know, there's some competition for this particular place.
Yeah. Just thinking, you know, about sort of, we're talking about now Nenny and Willock midfield. It wouldn't amaze me if someone like a Granit Xhaka played this game just because of, you know, not having the likelihood of Lucas Torreira not being involved, the possibility of Matteo Guendouzi not being involved.
Yeah.
The fact that Xhaka is made of metal and plays all the football, I think it's a possibility. But, you know, I'm expecting a rotated team. I'm half expecting to go out, to be honest, away to Leicester.
Leicester are playing, could be Man City, if I'm right.
Oh, really? At the weekend?
I think they're playing Man City at the weekend. So, again, I feel like, let me have a look at the fixtures here.
You're right. They've got Man City away on Sunday.
Yeah. So are they going to risk their best players for that game? Or do they look at the Man City game as, well, We're probably not going to win this anyway, so let's, you know, or can you even approach a game like that these days in the Premier League?
I also think Arsenal have got that extra bit of recovery for Anfield. You know, it is Monday, so I do wonder if someone like Xhaka and or Louise, for example, if you're thinking, well, if Louise comes through this, he could be in contention for Anfield. He has got time. It's a funny injury Louise has got. You know, it's a sort of neck injury, I think, and it's something that's going to need a bit of management. You know, I don't think it's a quick fix. So that's going to be an interesting one to see how they handle that in the coming weeks. It's interesting because he's been so important, hasn't he, to Arteta. But Gabriel's doing pretty well in that kind of central centre-half spot. And I wonder if they'll be a bit reluctant to, in the Premier League at least, take him out while he's kind of developing and performing well. How do you see that one going between them?
Well, I don't know. I mean, Luiz's injury is obviously a problem in the sense that, you know, he's somebody who would be starting because Mustafi's out, Chambers is still out, Pablo Mari is still out. So despite the fact we've got a lot of central defenders on our books, we don't have as many to call on as we might like, particularly as I think people had expected William Saliba to be, you know, at this point, a giant, a colossus, defender of all defenders, the Franz Beckenbauer of the next generation, already acclaimed as the greatest defensive signing that the world has ever seen. So there's a bit of a step back there, a bit of a reality check in terms of Saliba and you know, how ready he is or how ready they think he is. So we'd a question, actually. I'll just go on to it from the Discord from 1.76 Acres, who says, so having seen what we've seen from Gabriel, in admittedly a small sample, do you stick with him as a regular league starter and accept the mix-ups, rough edges, in order to develop someone who looks like a huge upside talent? He says, line-breaking passes, physical defensive skills, or once more players are healthy, do you slow it down a bit so he gets a paced, seemingly deliberate and more sheltered education? So just before you answer that, though, what did you think of Gabriel against West Ham?
I have to say, I wasn't as positive as everybody else. I had a few little concerns about him. I feel like he has been good, but he's also been a bit lucky in a couple of moments that could have gone the other way. You know, I think back to that moment in the first few minutes against Fulham. And there were a couple of moments at West Ham where I thought, oh, you know, Antonio is difficult and it could have gone the other way. I think he's been, what I was impressed by the way, I rewatched the kind of highlights of his performance in one of those clipped up YouTube things today against West Ham. And I was surprised watching it back at how good his passing looked and how effective he was at kind of playing passes in between the lines and playing the ball, you know, under pressure. I didn't expect that from him, really. And I think that's very reassuring that he's been able to do that. What have you made of him so far? What did you make of him against West Ham?
I thought he was okay against West Ham. I think, yeah, there were a couple of moments and there were a couple of perhaps headers where, you know, he got under it a little bit, didn't quite judge them correctly. But I think, you know, he had Kolasinac one side of him. He had Rob Holding the other side of him, who didn't have a particularly great game either. Yeah. And he's being asked to come in and play, you know, as the centre man in the you know, the heart of our three-man defence, having not played for a long time. So, you know, I don't think he's been perfect, but I didn't think he was bad against West Ham. As to the wider question, though, I'll go back to you on this one. So, you know, if we've got more players fit and ready, what do you do with Gabriel in Premier League terms?
Just to add, by the way, while I think he has been good, I am now acutely conscious of the kind of Arsenal trend of new signing being awarded player of the month in their first month. You know, and then 3 months later, everyone's like, actually, I don't know if I agree with that anymore. But no, he has been good. But player of the month for September, guaranteed. It's really tricky. I keep trying to figure out how to get Luiz and Gabriel in the same team. When I was thinking that we'd play a back four for the majority of this season, that was kind of my two. I didn't think Saliba would be ready to play, you know, regularly week in, week out. So I was thinking it'll be Gabriel and Luiz. If we stick with three, it becomes trickier, really, because I don't fancy Luiz in either of those roles in the channels. Do you know what I mean? Like getting run out in the channels by wingers like Tierney has to do. And to an extent, Holding has to do. If you're going to play Luiz, he's got to be in the middle there. I wonder if we might see Gabriel. Well, the thing is, I think you can't take him out. I think he is clearly the man for the future. And if he's in good form, it's very difficult to mount a case for pulling him out the side. I mean, you know, we all remember David Luiz at Anfield last year. Maybe we should just be sticking with Gabriel.
Well, look, I mean, I think the thing is, he's 22. He's not 18. There's a difference.
Yeah.
You know, he does have some experience under his belt. You know, who do we have who's got more potential in the squad? That's the thing. You know, Pablo Marie, maybe there might be a way of sharing game time with Pablo Marie. But, you know, to be quite honest, we don't really know how good either of these two guys are because we haven't really seen them. Pablo Marie's played, what, twice? It was third game, maybe, that he got that injury, and we haven't seen him. So we haven't really been able to judge him in Premier League terms. And Gabriel has had two games, two wins. I think he's done pretty well in both of those games. But there's obviously a long way to go, a long season. So I think this is one of the issues or one of the things that Mikel Arteta is really going to have to think about is how he sets up his defence and what way he plays with those players in place. Because, as we said earlier, if you've got Tierney in your back three, you can play one way. But if it's Pablo Marie or if it's Gabriel, you've got to play a slightly different way.
Yeah, so, I mean, the way I see it, if you're going to play Tierney in that back three, obviously he's got to play that left-sided role. I think if you're going to play Luiz, for me, I mean, I might be wrong about this, but he kind of has to play the central role. And that leaves you with one berth on the right-hand side, and you don't want to stick Gabriel in there. So I feel like at the moment you are kind of having to choose between Luiz and Gabriel, and maybe we're going to have to move on from Luiz eventually, I mean, almost certainly in 12 months' time. So maybe we should be, if things are falling out in such a way that's enabling us to do that now, perhaps we should be embracing it. Which I thought Luiz was going to have a massive role to play this season, and maybe he will. Maybe Gabriel will be pulled out the side and Luiz will play a lot of games. But it is difficult to figure out how he and Gabriel, you know, play together in the current shape. What about this question? Joshy Guna, who's at Joshy Abbott, says, "Morning, guys. With Leno against West Ham, I don't feel like he has the presence or comfortableness, I'm making up words now, on the ball that Emi had. Do you think this is just from a lack of game time / gelling with the current back line, or should we be concerned?"
I don't think he is quite as dominant as Emi Martinez. And, you know, he's also just a little bit smaller than Emi Martinez as well. Like, Emi Martinez is a huge guy. He's a really big guy. I didn't really think Leno was quite as bad as some people were saying. Like, I think there were a couple of moments. The bit where he landed on his face on top of the ball, that was a bit like, uh-oh. But as I said, I think that that was a little bit of an accident. He didn't have a huge amount to do. I would have to look at the stats. I mean, what were his passing stats?
There was one where he punched, and I remember watching it and thinking, Emi catches that.
Yeah, maybe.
And I know people, you know, argue for punching, and there's a sort of there's a degree of proof about its efficacy. But yeah, I mean, look, I can't lie. I didn't think Leno was bad, but I didn't think he had the same degree of assurance in this game that Martinez had shown in his recent performances.
Well, yeah, and people talking about him not being as good on the ball, he'd 90% pass completion. That's a goalkeeper.
Yeah.
You know,
he looks slightly more awkward on the ball. I think it is a visual thing. I think that his stats and Martinez's stats measure up pretty well, but just he doesn't look. You know how we were talking about when we were saying Xhaka when he passes with his right? You know, sometimes a footballer just looks very comfortable on the ball, and Leno doesn't have that capacity, I don't think.
Yeah, he doesn't look quite as assured on the ball as Emi did.
But it doesn't seem to massively affect his output. But it's sort of a, I think it's a look thing, you know?
Yeah, I think there was a question on the Facebook page as well. Martin Earle says, is Leno trying a little too hard to dominate the box to show he is as good as Martinez? Which might be slightly tongue-in-cheek. But I doubt, you know, he's performing in a way. It's like, well, I'll show you. I can do what Emi Martinez did. It doesn't matter now because Emi Martinez is gone and he's going to play for Aston Villa tonight. We're going to sign Ronnie Runnerson. And maybe the other guy. That was interesting, wasn't it? When Arteta was asked about it at his press conference, you know, if the signing of the Icelandic guy was the end of the pursuit of David Raya, he was like, well, we'll have to wait and see what happens with the third choice goalkeeper, because there is obviously talk that Matt Macey is going to go. So whether they feel they need to bring somebody in or if they're ready to promote one of the guys from underneath. That was slightly interesting. Maybe not that interesting now that I said it out loud.
No. I just think we can't underline enough how dogged Arsenal have been in their pursuit of David Raya, to the point that they've been told by Brentford, this man is not for sale.
Fuck off. Just fuck off.
I mean, basically, yes. And Brentford, when Brentford don't want to sell you a player, they don't do it. They're a pretty well-run club. They made a lot of money out of someone like Ollie Watkins this summer. Benrahma's probably going to go. They've got no need to do it. And Arsenal have kept knocking on the door, kept trying to find a solution, contemplated, you know, slightly mad-sounding things like loaning him back there for a year. Mm. All sorts of stuff, because they really, really want the player. And I think they'll keep doing that probably until the window shuts, because, you know, Runarsson's coming in, but he's not coming in to great fanfare and at huge expense. And I think, you know, I'm not sure he's coming in with everyone thinking he's going to be a guy that's going to play, you know, every Europa League game. Yeah. Maybe he will. But maybe it feels like he's a definitive backup where he is right now.
For sure. I think there's something really interesting about this in terms of, you know, how this is happening. And Arteta spoke about it over the weekend, where he said, you know, obviously it'll be me who makes the decision about who comes in. But he says, you know, when it comes to the goalkeeper, he's talking about Iñaki Caña-Pavón. He's saying he's a big say on how we're going to implement our methodology, how we're going to treat the goalkeeping position. And he said, you know, along the lines of, I want to lean on their expertise. Now, the reason this guy, Alex Runarsson, is coming to Arsenal is because of the relationship he has with the goalkeeping coach.
Yeah.
Right? It's not because he has been performing at such a great level at Dijon that we're going, well, this is a great chance for us to bring in a really, you know, solid number two goalkeeper. He hasn't been solid at Dijon. He's had a really difficult time. I don't know if you listened to the Arsecast on Friday. Matt Spiro was on and, you know, was being quite diplomatic, I think, about how things have gone for him. Now, it can happen. A player goes to a club, it doesn't really work out, circumstances, environment, whatever it might be, it happens. He goes to a different club, everything's nicer, better, and he plays better as well. But I think there's a big responsibility now. If Arteta is taking the word of his goalkeeping coach that this guy is good enough to do what we want a goalkeeper to do, which is quite specific now. It's not what it used to be. You know, we need the guy to be able to play out from the back. That's an important part of what we want to do. And he's obviously got to do all the other goalkeeping stuff as well. So he's advocating for this guy to come in, despite the fact he's had a terrible time. Arteta's got to put a lot of trust in that guy's opinion of this player. And if it doesn't work out, I'm not saying it won't, but if it doesn't, I just think there's an interesting dynamic there.
It's a hell of a gamble, yeah. That Iñaki Caña is taking by saying, look, I vouch for this guy.
Particularly as he, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, he is very, very much part of the reason why we are so after David Raya.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's a player he admires enormously. They've got a great personal relationship. And actually, I think, you know, everyone looks at Raya and thinks, OK, he's coming here. If Arsenal get him, he's coming here as a number two. And I think in the first instance, that is true. But I don't think that Iñaki would be pushing so hard for Raya if he didn't think that he could give Leno a run for his money in the long run. And I think, to be honest, I think what a lot of this is about style. So what you and I probably quite like about Emi Martinez, which is his size, his frame, the fact he comes and gets crosses, is probably not necessarily the first things that Iñaki Caña's looking for. I know that might sound strange, but I think him and Arteta probably have had conversations about a vision of what a goalkeeper needs to be in this team, a very modern idea. You know, can they come out and play as almost the third centre-half, as a sweeper?
Did you see how high Leno was? They were talking about it in commentary on Saturday, that Leno was playing really high up the pitch midway through, maybe late in the second half.
Yeah. And that's something that Runarsson, for example, was quite comfortable doing in his time working with Iñaki Caña. And I think it's something that they want to implement. I remember when they came back from lockdown, Emi Martinez gave an interview about what they'd been talking about in lockdown. He said, you know, the coaching staff have been speaking to us about higher starting positions. And I think we will see more of that. So it feels like what's happening here, I mean, Arteta's talked about specificity in the past with the recruitment, and it feels like what's happening is there is a very specific idea of the sort of goalkeeper that Arteta and Caña want to function in this team. Now, there's still a question of quality, and I think it'll be interesting to see if Runarsson's kind of up to the job, even though he is sort of stylistically a good fit. I mean, how much emphasis do you place on the importance of a good second choice goalkeeper? Because I think that's an interesting debate, and there are people who will make the case quite cogently for both sides there.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think more and more there's a desire, or we feel better when we've got fail-safes. You know, as fans, we feel better knowing that if Leno is injured, we've got Emi Martinez. Now, we feel better about that scenario now than we would have done, let's say, 6 months ago, or indeed when Leno got injured. I don't think there was quite the same assurance in Emi Martinez, was there? You know, but you know, you get people who say, well, we need a good backup for this player, but then do you need backup for the backup? And that kind of thing, you know? I'm sort of in the middle of it in the sense that I can see, and have seen, obviously, in the last few weeks, just what the benefit of having a very good number two goalkeeper can be because of what Emi Martinez did and how he helped us win the FA Cup and everything else. I'm also not blind to the fact that, you know, all going well, your number two goalkeeper is not going to play that often, you know, particularly in Premier League terms. You're going to find it really difficult to hang on to two very good goalkeepers. You end up in situations where you're making decisions kind of as favours for the goalkeepers. I wrote about this at the weekend where, you know, we've had three cup finals where we've played our second choice keeper, which is, it's mad. It is mad. You know, Chesney is our best goalkeeper and played the 2015 FA Cup final because he was out in the cold because of the smoking thing or whatever the fuck went down there. And Ospina was the Premier League goalkeeper. But Chesney played in the cup final. Fabianski, like 9 years. 9 years we hadn't won a trophy, and Chesney was week in, week out our number one goalkeeper, and we played Fabianski. We got away with it, but, you know, it's still a mad decision. Similarly, 2017, Cech was the number one goalkeeper. We played Ospina. He was terrible for the goal that Chelsea scored, but we got away with it. And I feel like sometimes if you don't have that decision to make, because there's such an obvious gulf in quality between your number one goalkeeper and your number two goalkeeper, you're probably better off. So I'm a little bit stuck on it. Like, I want us to have a good number two goalkeeper, but I'm not sure in the grand scheme of things it makes that much of a difference.
No, I mean, I always think, you know, Arsenal won the league, didn't we, with you know, Richard Wright and Stuart Taylor both getting Premier League medals. I think if your outfield players are good enough, I think a goalkeeper can be the difference, but I think if your outfield players are good enough, it's generally okay. I mean, Adrian played a fair bit of football for Liverpool last season and they won the league. I think If it comes down to a choice between a starting central midfielder and a second choice goalkeeper, there is no choice.
Yeah, of course. Do you know what I mean? Of course. Yeah.
And that is, I think, the sort of position Arsenal are in. So that's kind of the way I see it. Interesting though, and yeah, interesting to see who plays. I mean, there's not a lot of confidence, I don't think, internally in Matt Macey. He is kind of headed for the exit, so it'll be interesting if he does play on Wednesday. I mean, I guess a great opportunity for him to put himself in the shop window. Let's have another question. Okay, Mario Silva. Oh, by the way, just quickly, when Leno fell down and obviously nearly broke his neck, I was thinking, can you believe it? The week we've sold Emi Martinez.
The week Leno's we've sold it, burned Leno gets paralysed.
Yeah, I know, Jeez. Genuinely, that's what I was thinking.
Only at Arsenal.
So Mario Silva says, does it worry you that in Torreira we are letting go of a player who's not tapped into his whole potential too soon? I mean, if Atletico want him, he's got to be a good player, right? What are your thoughts?
Am I worried that we are letting go of a player who hasn't released or realised his potential? No, not really. Which isn't to say I don't think Torreira is a good player. I just don't think Torreira and Arsenal fit. Which is unfortunate, but that happens sometimes. I'm not sure Torreira feels that comfortable at Arsenal / in England, whatever that might be. You know, he's had some injury problems, of course, and I think he would prefer to leave to go somewhere else. So I'm not worried about that aspect of it. You know, all signings are gambles, and sometimes a player who you bring in just won't do it at your club, and he needs a change to go and do it somewhere elsewhere. I mean, look at Mo Salah, for example. Chelsea, or look at Kevin De Bruyne, also at Chelsea. It's quite funny when it happens to Chelsea. You know, who went somewhere else and then, you know, came back and were better players. I don't think that's going to be the case with Torreira, because I think he sort of suits continental football, Latin football perhaps a bit more, you know, than he does the Premier League, where I think the size issue is a bit more of a thing than it would be in Spain and Italy. My concern would be that we don't get value for him when he goes. You know, I've seen some of the talk about Atletico Madrid, and I have a question here actually, which I'll ask you in a second, but you know, 1 year loan deals with X amount and this amount from Italy. I mean, I think there is an issue as well with the player side of things. He earns well at Arsenal, and it's not quite as easy to earn as well at some of the clubs that he's been linked with. You know, Fiorentina or Torino, for example, aren't going to be able to pay what Arsenal pay. And that is a consideration. That's part of the problem. So in the current market, with the way we need to generate funds, my concern isn't so much Torreira's departure, it's that we get the right value for it.
Yeah, and at the moment, the discussions with Atletico are about a loan deal. We don't know yet if that could be, you know, a loan with an obligation or a loan with an option. But, you know, that does... I mean, people were unhappy about that when I tweeted it last night, because, you know, they want to see us getting money that we can use immediately. It may be that if we've offered some sort of guarantee or possibility of money down the line, that may free up Arsenal to spend some more money in the short term. I don't know how the club's finances will be structured, but that's, you know, not impossible. I don't really worry about letting him go. I think when I look at how certain players have benefited from Mikel Arteta's presence at the club. I know Torreira had his injury, but I kind of feel like if it was going to happen for him at all at Arsenal, I feel like it would have happened to an extent with Arteta. You know, even when Tierney was out injured, Arteta was kind of raving about him. You know, there's never really been that with Torreira. And I think you were right to make the point about he's not settled in England. Actually, one of his big mates at the club is Emi Martinez. Yeah. He's just left. You know, I do think going to a Latin environment probably is going to suit him better. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, that it's Atletico who are after him. They obviously have a midfielder who we have been after.
Well,
you know.
Yeah. CJ90 on the Discord says, Atletico Madrid want Torreira, Arsenal want Partey. What am I missing here? Can't both players be incorporated into some form of swap deal between the two clubs? This one should be easy.
You would like to think so. I mean, listen, just because they're discussing a loan with Torreira does not mean they're not discussing a permanent deal with Partey. Sometimes, as a sweetener or to make negotiations go a bit easier, you might relax the terms of one deal to help you do another. We've seen that in this window plenty of times already this season. Players who aren't necessarily moving in part exchange, but who swap clubs. I'm thinking, you know, maybe Jota went to Liverpool and they sent their young Dutch centre-half, whose name escapes me now, to Wolves in a permanent deal. They were separate deals, but they kind of sat down at the table and hammered them out together. Everybody wins. Maybe something like that could happen with Torreira.
It's more difficult when one of those, one half of that deal is just like a loan for a season.
Yes, it is. It is. And it's more difficult. I mean, you know, Atletico ultimately don't want to lose Partey, or if they do, they want, you know, the full amount. I still think they think, I imagine they think, that, you know, Arsenal could turn up with that money on deadline day. You know, and that's the problem with that negotiation, is that ultimately there is an amount you have to pay to get him, and Atletico probably suspect Arsenal will become desperate enough that they might do it.
Yeah, but isn't the whole point of the release clause that you have to pay the whole thing in one go? So, A, Arsenal are going to have to sell. They're going to have to sell to raise that kind of money. That's obvious. Are they going to splash all that money? If they have 50 million in cash, are they going to spend it all on one player? When with 50 million liquid, you could do quite a bit in the transfer market if you're spreading out fees and everything else across you know, a number of seasons. So it does feel like the kind of thing that 2 + 2 = 4. Torreira's going one way. I'm not saying they're the same kind of player, but you know, central midfielder in, central midfielder out. It does make a lot of sense, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure what's going to happen.
It's just rare, isn't it, that these deals kind of with true swaps involved work out. And the reason Atletico, by the way, are holding out for that money is because they want that money, you know, 50 million euros or whatever it is up front in cash. To get that in the midst of coronavirus and everything else that's going on would be a lottery win for them.
Yeah.
As much as they value Partey. So, you know, this is going to play on and play out. But Torreira is going to go. It's just a question of how Arsenal can leverage the interest in him best to suit their purposes. And a one-year loan without an obligation doesn't feel like the best option.
Well, it depends what the loan fee is.
Well, that's true. Because you could say, take a chunky loan fee for him now, and maybe the economy, you know, settles down a bit in 12 months' time. And actually, after a great season with Atletico Madrid, his market value is higher.
Yeah.
You know, it's not necessarily foolish. This is a bad time to be selling players. The values are slightly depressed, you know, 20 to 30%, some agents are saying. So, you know, maybe this isn't a good time to sell. It's with players under long-term contract, that is.
Yeah. It is.
It's a really difficult kind of juggling act Arsenal have to do, isn't it, in the remainder of this window?
Yeah, it is. And look, there are a lot of complicated situations. We had another one here. It was a question on the Discord. It was about Lacazette. From cautiously optimistic Gunnar.
A man after like my own heart. Yeah.
Hedging his bets right there. Well, he says, what do you make of the Lacazette contract situation? I know you vocalize that you're unimpressed with him, so I'm curious to hear whether or not you think we should move him on and invest more in Nketiah, and he mentions Balogun as well. And then he says it's a curious one because if we move him on, we could move Aubameyang central, have Saka, Martinelli on the left, etc., etc. But he was asked specifically about this, wasn't he, at the weekend? There are no contract talks planned for Lacazette. He's saying we've got other things we need to do in the market first, which, you know, you can make sense of. But if you want to offer a guy a new contract, it's not like the most complicated process in the entire world. You can do what you need to do in the transfer market and also just agree a new contract with a player if you want to give him one. You know, these are, you know, potentially the easiest things. I know the Aubameyang one was more complicated, but, you know, Lacazette is happy. And if Arsenal wanted to sign Lacazette to a new contract, I'd say they could do it in about 10 minutes if they really wanted to. So,
yeah,
you know, what do you make of what's going on with Lacazette? And is it a case that, you know, the announcement or the revelation that we're not giving him a new deal is basically a kind of, well, come and get him. Let's hear your offers.
I think Arsenal would be open to offers for Lacazette. I do think that. And I think, you know, there's a few reasons for that. The possibility of Aubameyang central is one. I think we saw at times last season Arteta kind of preferred Nketiah in some games. I think he likes Nketiah probably more than most fans, I think. I think he really does seem to believe in him. Martinelli as well is something to consider. Also, you've got the options out there on the market. Look, I think I rate Lacazette a bit higher than most at the moment. I think that he is maybe a little bit underrated. I mean, I heard Alan Smith, I think, was the commentator on Sky the other day, and he said he's really struggled in the last 2 years, Lacazette. And I was like, he was player of the year in one of those years. But I accept that in the last 12 months, he's not been at that level for the most part. But I do think that kind of, in the big games last season, in the cup run, I think he did deliver. I think he did work exceptionally hard in that role. And I'm not sure how easy it is to buy, for what we'd get for Lacazette, I'm not sure how easy it is to buy someone as good. Genuinely, I'm really, really not sure.
Yeah, look, I think he has been obviously effective from a goal scoring point of view so far this season. 2 goals in 2 games, can't argue with that, particularly when, you know, his goal scoring is something that has been under the spotlight. It was his 50th goal and it was what, 130 appearances? That's you know, it's not great for a striker who had a much higher strike rate in France, and I know it's a different league and everything else. And I sort of agree with you in that I think he is a useful player, certainly in the system that we're using, certainly in the role that Mikel Arteta wants him to play. But I just look at him and I see a guy who just looks a bit like he's slowing down, still needs to take the touch a bit too often. There was one moment in the first half, wasn't there, where it opened up for him and he took a touch and he was blocked off, and maybe a first-time shot, a snappier striker would have got a shot away. I just think at 29, with what we're seeing from him on a physical level, you know, a guy who, when he arrived, didn't really do 90 minutes, ever. And now, even after a few years, isn't doing 90 minutes.
I don't think he's ever going to.
You know,
he's
so
29, you know,
he's not a 90-minute player at 29 years of age, which is, you know, I would be inclined, if at all possible, to move him on while I think his, before I should say, I think his physical issues become more pronounced. And that's not to say I don't think he can't do a job for us in this team. It's good to have experienced players. But if you're asking me for the ideal, I would move him on. Of course, it's all dependent on who comes in.
Yeah, I think
or,
that's
you know,
it.
And I mean, with an offer, rather.
I think that's it. You know, is there an offer out there? And also, something really interesting about Lacazette, that someone who used to work for Arsenal told me one time, is that actually, in salary terms, he is not deemed expensive. So while we did pay a big transfer fee for him, you know, his kind of annual cost to us is not enormous on his current deal. And because of that, I wonder if there might be a temptation to let the contract run down by another year. I'm not sure, but I just think, you know, it's not going to cost us, you know, what it costs to keep Ozil for 12 months, to keep Lacazette. You know, he was a £50 million transfer fee, but he's not really on wages in that bracket. So I do wonder if they might be a little bit more relaxed about his situation than they might be with certain others. But it's a really interesting one. I mean, if we play in the current system we play, and Aubameyang stays on the left, we need somebody in that centre forward role as well as Nketiah, don't we? And so, you know, it's tempting to think, oh, take the Lacazette money and divert that in central midfield, but that would probably leave us a bit light if Aubameyang stays on the left.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe.
This is it, though. Like, it's the juggling act, you know? The club didn't really want to sell, you know, Emi Martinez. Or, you know, it's, you know, you don't... There can be players that you like that you have to sell. And that is the situation that we're in.
Mm. Okay. Have you got one more? I've got one more if you don't have one more, but I'm happy to take one.
Covered, I mean, just this from Jakob Olafsson, it's kind of related, really, but how important could Nketiah be this season? Seems to be an important member of the squad, both as a starter and a substitute.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like you said, he was starting games towards the end of, or during last season when Lacazette was on the bench. And I think, you know, that was a sign of faith in him from Mikel Arteta. You know, Lacazette a much more experienced option, and if Lacazette has responded to that and it's helped his goal scoring, then good. But I do think they obviously they think highly of Nketiah. He's a penalty box striker, I think, and maybe it's quite interesting that he is being developed perhaps for a style which we're not necessarily seeing quite yet. You think of the way Man City worked the ball, and they worked the ball into the area, and how many tap-ins do they score?
Yeah.
So I do wonder if there's something like that going on with Nketiah and the way that we might develop as a team to sort of get more out of him as a penalty box striker. Look, all you can do when you're given a chance is come on and score goals. He scored a few goals for us now. He's still only 20, so I think there's a way to go physically, and he's obviously got to mature. But I think he's going to be important unless we do make a signing. And I think as the season goes on, his energy and his ability to press higher and faster and sharper and longer than Lacazette might be very useful.
Yeah, and as much as I say, you know, I rate Lacazette higher than some others, I have a hunch and Nketiah will start plenty of games this season. I really do.
Okay, just final one then, very quickly, we'll do this. It comes from Rambo on the Discord, who says, what would be a good return from the next five fixtures in the Premier League? We've Liverpool away, Sheffield United at home, Man City away, Leicester at home, Man United away. What's a good return? I presume he means points.
So Liverpool and City away, Sheffield United, Leicester. Oh, it's United away as well.
Mm.
Ooh, spicy. I think we've got to win the home games.
Mm-hmm.
So that's six. What would be a good return? I think a really good return would be 10 points. But 9 would be acceptable. Now, 9 would be good too. Honestly, 9 would be good too.
9 would be good because, yeah, it could be 3 wins or, yeah.
It could be, you know, if Arsenal lose 2 of those away games and win 1, you know, in some ways that's worth as much, isn't it, as drawing.
Well, you could draw all 5. You've only got 5 points. You're unbeaten, but, you know, in pure points terms.
I'm going to say I would be content with 9. What about you?
I think 9 is not bad when you consider City away and Liverpool away are really, really difficult. Really difficult. You know, I know we've
above 9 is great.
Yeah. And I think if we beat Sheffield United, beat Leicester at home and, you know, beat Manchester United away, which I think we're perfectly capable of doing given the state of United. Now, of course, by the time we play United, the window will have closed, so they could be stronger, but then so could we.
We'll have Partey and Aouar by then.
Aouar, yeah, so, of course, yeah.
And crucially, we'll have David Raya.
Of course. I have 15 points, 15 points all the way. Yeah, I think 9 would be reasonable. I think 9 would be good, because I think you can compartmentalize games against City and Liverpool because of where they are and their, you know, development and trajectory. But it would be nice.
Those sides recently.
Yeah, we have. I know. But it would be nice to go to Anfield and come away with something. And it would be nice to go to Man City, or it would be nice, you know, to play Man City in the Premier League and come away with something, because it's been too long since we did that. So, yeah, if we can take a point from even one of those games and make it 10, I think that would be a very good return.
Couldn't agree more. Let's hope so. But 15 as well. I'll take 15.
I'll take them. But, you know, let's not be too greedy at this point of the season. Maybe save some of those points for later on. All right. We'll leave it there. Thank you very much indeed for listening. Thanks for being here as always. We'll have all the bits and pieces for you during the week. Of course, we've got Carabao Cup coming up on
Wednesday.
And, yeah, all the rest. So, look, thanks as ever for being here. Enjoy your week. As we speculate on what kind of a team we'll see in that Carabao Cup game. Until the next one, take it easy.
Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.